At the June 50th anniversary meeting of the NSABP, our group set up a CME symposium to launch this memorable weekend, and perhaps the most interesting moment came at the beginning when Dr. Norman Walmark, the group chair, announced to the membership that an agreement had been reached for the NSABP to join the U.S. Oncology TIC-TAC trial comparing TC to TAC. Of particular interest was the addition of a third arm combining TC with bevacizumab for what is now the tic-tac-toe trial. One of the faculty for the symposium was Dr. Kathy Miller, who chairs a major ECOG and intergroup adjuvant trial evaluating the addition of bevacizumab to an anthracycline-based regimen. I met with Dr. Miller immediately after the symposium to get her take on this and other new developments on the anti-angiogenic forefront, and she began her conversation by commenting on her ECOG adjuvant trial.
When we started designing the trial to look at the adjuvant setting, we had to think about whether there were unique safety concerns. And that's really because we do a good job of diagnosing patients earlier in the highest risk adjuvant trials. Still, well more than half of the patients did fine in the control groups of our studies, and many would do fine with no systemic therapy. So toxicities that might be rare and not of concern at all in the metastatic setting are a bigger concern in the adjuvant setting. When we thought about the bevacizumab toxicities, most of them we thought were not likely to be big issues. So the arterial thrombotic events are rare in the metastatic population. We expect them to even be more rare in the relatively healthier, younger adjuvant population. The venous thromboembolic events are also likely to be uncommon and certainly not prohibitive. Proteinuria is a fairly rare toxicity to be of any clinical importance, and it improves with time off therapy. Hypertension is actually the one that I have the biggest concerns about, but those are long-term concerns that may not become apparent for 10 or 15 or 30 years, so we're sort of stuck with those. The one that we were concerned about was cardiac toxicity. And at the time we first started thinking about adjuvant therapy, there had been reports of less than 100 patients treated collectively in three separate trials in different settings with different anthracycline regimens. But they all raised the question of either clinical congestive heart failure or patients who were asymptomatic but had decreases in ejection fraction to levels that we would find concerning, so less than 40%. The problem was, with such small numbers, the confidence intervals were very wide, and they reported clinical events ranging from 0 to up to 27% of patients with congestive heart failure. That's a big difference. If it's really 0, you would go forward with an adjuvant trial with very little monitoring. If it's really 27%, you're not going to go forward. So we designed a pilot trial specifically to make sure that the rates of clinically apparent congestive heart failure were not prohibitive. And we had somewhat arbitrarily agreed ahead of time that a rate of clinical CHF of 10% or more would be prohibitive, or for the average patient, it was unlikely that the benefits of therapy, even if there were benefits, would outweigh that potential risk, and we should look at other strategies.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about the current ECOG adjuvant study, the design, and sort of what the rationale was for the design.
So the design of E5103, which is the large adjuvant study, I think encompasses several features in its design. It has a practical element in that we allow patients and their physicians to select whether they prefer AC every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks, and we'll stratify for that choice so it won't impact our results. It builds on the historical improvements that we've been able to make in adjuvant therapy over the years. So the backbone of the chemotherapy is 4 cycles of AC, followed by a taxane. And it also incorporates our best scientific information. So in this trial, the taxane is specifically weekly paclitaxel. That's a bit of building on history from the E1199 study and the adjuvant trastuzumab studies, but it's specifically taking the information from the E2100 trial in the metastatic setting and the preclinical data of potential synergy between lower dose but more continuous taxane exposure and bevacizumab.
With the idea that that lower, more continuous dose is somehow anti-angiogenic?
In laboratory studies, the taxanes do have a separate, clearly separate effect on endothelial cells that you see at doses much lower than the doses that are required to have any direct cytotoxic effect on the tumor cells. But to get that effect, you need to use that drug fairly continuously or with more prolonged exposure. And that's essentially what we get with weekly schedules, lower dose but more continuous exposure to the drug. Now, it's very hard to prove separate antiangiogenic activity in the clinic, though there's actually one study that suggests that this might be real, and that's an unrelated study looking at neoadjuvant treatment of patients with localized breast cancers, where they randomized them to either doxorubicin as monotherapy or paclitaxel as monotherapy and measure changes in tumor interstitial pressure. And they saw equivalent response rates in the two arms, but apparently by a different mechanism, because there were significant decreases in tumor interstitial pressure with paclitaxel and really no change with doxorubicin, suggesting that you could get to the same place if you're just measuring tumor by two very different ways, and that may inform which combinations might actually be the most fruitful.
So you don't allow dose-dense Q2-weeks Taxol in this? It's just Q-week?
No dose-dense, no every 3 weeks, no docetaxel. The taxane component of the treatment is absolutely specified as weekly paclitaxel.
And what's the entry criteria?
So entry criteria for E5103 are also a little bit different than people have seen before. It's open to everyone with node-positive disease, though if I had my druthers, it might not be. And we allow patients who have node-negative disease but are at high risk, and that's where the difference in eligibility comes in. So we've still considered anyone with a tumor over 1 centimeter who's ER-negative to be at high risk. But ER-positive patients are only considered to be at high risk if they have really big tumors, and we've defined that as greater than 5 centimeters. Or if they have tumors between 1 and 5 centimeters with an Oncotype DX recurrence score that is not particularly low. And for this trial, we've chosen the low cutoff as 11, so it matches the Taylor-X trial. If someone enrolls in the Taylor-X trial and they have a high-risk score or they're in the intermediate-risk score and they're assigned to chemotherapy, they're welcome to participate in E5103 as the way that chemotherapy is delivered. So we chose those cutoffs specifically to match that ongoing trial.
So obviously, adjuvant Bev is a big question in cancer in general. There's the colon study sitting out there. There's a lung study that's just getting started. And I guess one of the questions is going to be, how's Bev going to play out in the adjuvant setting in terms of what we think, maybe the way it's working?
Well, obviously, I think it will be effective or I wouldn't have spent all this time writing the trial. But there are hypotheses really and potentially evidence on both sides. If you think about angiogenesis as being one of the earliest things that a tumor cell must do, we see evidence of angiogenesis in breast tumors, even in DCIS, when the tumors are not yet invasive. So it truly is a very early phenomenon. And that would also suggest that adjuvant therapy might be more effective. In studies that have looked at expression of proangiogenic factors from atypical but not yet malignant lesions to DCIS to invasive disease, you see more and more angiogenic factors expressed as the tumors become older, if you will. That would also suggest that drugs like bevacizumab that inhibit a single agent might be more effective earlier in the course of the disease, which would bring you to the adjuvant setting. But there are questions as well. These are microscopic deposits that may be below the size where angiogenesis is an absolute requirement for them to survive. So perhaps this won't add as much as we think. I have concerns that this might not even be early enough based on some preclinical animal modeling data that finds that tumor cells are not the first cells that arrive at site of metastasis, but some VEGFR1-driven progenitor cells are sent from the bone marrow first to sites of metastasis and sort of prepare a local microenvironment, if you will. If that's already happened and those cells are potentially protected from the effects of inhibiting VEGF because of their interaction with those stromal cells, then perhaps we might not get the attended effect. I think there are also questions about duration of therapy. And we are giving bevacizumab for two durations in E5103. The control group obviously will get none, and then there's a group that will get bevacizumab for roughly 6 months concurrently with the chemotherapy, and a group that will get Bev for roughly a year with chemo and an additional 6 months. And perhaps that's not long enough. Perhaps you truly need chronic therapy, and that what we don't do with this therapy is eliminate microscopic disease, but we merely keep it from growing so that if you remove that foot on the brake, you will have prolonged the time to progression, but perhaps not prevented recurrence or changed overall survival.
So I try to keep up with what's going on here, but I got a real surprise when I came here and found out that the NSABP now is interested in expanding the tic-tac study, which is TC versus TAC, to the tic-tac-toe study now looking at adjuvant Bev with TC. Were you aware of that? I never heard of that.
It's the first I've heard. What I actually find encouraging about that is not the Bev arm. What I think is important about that is increasing the sample size of the TIC-TAC trial.
Right.
I think we are all interested in having a randomized trial that needs to be large enough to be definitive to really investigate the potential benefits of anthracyclines in HER2-negative patients. We've always been enthusiastic about the TIC-TAC trial design. Our problem with that trial, unfortunately, has been the case with other U.S. oncology trials, that it's simply too small. It's not designed to test equivalence. It's designed to show that TAC is superior. And it's looking for a pretty big improvement, a bigger improvement than we have in the past required studies to show. So it's a bit small and has the potential for results that might suggest that anthracyclines are better, but not be able to really be definitive. So I think the most encouraging part that I heard tonight was that this will result in the anthracycline versus no anthracycline randomization be bigger. Adding an additional TC arm with Bev, I think, is interesting, but it doesn't particularly address a scientific hypothesis. And it will be adding Bev to an every 3-week docetaxel regimen. And I think people have had very different reactions to the results of the Avato trial. It certainly is statistically a positive trial.
Can you explain what that looked like? Because it was just presented at ASCO.
Sure. So Avato is the trial that everyone was waiting for. It was sort of the European equivalent of my E2100 trial with an important addition. So Avato had 3 arms, docetaxel alone at the European-favored 100 milligram per meter squared dose with a placebo. So this was a placebo-controlled trial. Or 2 bevacizumab arms, 7.5 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks, so half the dose we've typically used in breast cancer studies, or 15 milligrams per kilogram. Not designed to be analyzed as a 3-arm trial, not designed to compare directly the 2 bevacizumab arms, designed as 2 pairwise comparisons, low-dose Bev versus placebo, high-dose Bev versus placebo. Statistically significant improvements in response rates and progression-free survival that were their primary endpoints. But in absolute terms, progression-free survival is that I found a bit disappointing. So in the control group, progression-free survival was 8 months. It increased to 8.7 months in patients in the low-dose bevacizumab group, 8.8 months in the high-dose group. Now, the medians always become a bit tricky because we really need to look at the shape of the curves. And it's clear that the curves separate early. They remain separate throughout most of the period of follow-up. So this is a real difference and I think is a bigger difference than the roughly 1 month medians might suggest. But 8.8 months is still not 11.8 months. And every 3-week docetaxel, you wouldn't predict to take advantage of the potential anti-angiogenic activity of the taxanes because of the high dose and the intermittent schedule. I'm now even more interested in the results of the Ribbon trial because I think it really calls into question the assumption that you can add bevacizumab to any chemotherapy and get the same results. You may be able to add bevacizumab to any chemotherapy and improve the results that you might have expected from that chemotherapy alone, but the magnitude of the improvement might be very different. Or said another way, there might be particular drugs and schedules that are much more synergistic and give you a greater bang for the combination than you would get with others. And every 3-week docetaxel compared to weekly paclitaxel may be one of those.
I guess one of the issues, too, is in terms of protocol accrual, now having 2 adjuvant Bev studies out there, are we going to be able to get, you know, quick accrual for both of those studies? I think the adjuvant Bev question obviously was of great interest with colon cancer, accrued like crazy. I'm not sure what's happening right now with the ECOG study, and do you think having another trial out there is going to be a problem?
Well, as the PI of a trial, accrual is always a worry for me. E5103 is actually slightly ahead of schedule from the accrual goals that we had set for the trial. So the TIC-TAC trial has been up and running in U.S. Oncology. It's always hard to tell if it's actually hurt accrual to E5103, but if it has, it's been to a very minor extent because 5103 is accruing very well. There are certainly NSABP members who are enrolling patients on E5103 with access to that trial in the CT TSU, they've been a fairly minor component of the accrual at this point. So whether that will change if they are able to join the tic-tac trial and make it a tic-tac-toe trial, I think will probably take 6 months to a year before we have a full sense of that. And by that point, I think we're going to be very confident that 5103 will be enrolling well and will not have a big impact.
I guess the other thing that 5103 gets into is this issue of anthracyclines. And since everybody's going to get an anthracycline, we've seen a big movement in our patterns of care studies away from anthracyclines, even in node-positive patients. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, I can tell you at this point, it certainly hasn't hurt accrual to 5103. So I certainly think there may be physicians in the community who might reach for a non-anthracycline regimen in the lower risk population, might dissuade them from enrolling lower risk patients into E5103 because it uses an anthracycline backbone. But we're enrolling quite nicely, and if that means we have a slightly higher risk population in E5103, that actually doesn't bother me. In my mind, E5103 is a trial for the higher risk populations, and that means we'll have more events and we'll get the results quicker. So if that's the impact, it doesn't bother me. On a more global scale, I worry that people have rushed to judgment on the basis of one small underpowered trial initially reported as a negative study, not done by a cooperative group, not done with an independent data monitoring committee, didn't collect blocks for correlative studies. The trial was well done and the results look very promising, but there are some important caveats there. And we also have to realize that there's really never been a regimen that has been less effective than AC, so being better than just four cycles of AC every 3 weeks is not a particularly tough hurdle. And you can get equivalent results with CMF. You can get better by adding paclitaxel every 3 weeks, the way to give it the least effective, we now understand. You can get better by adding docetaxel after. You're probably better by doing it concurrently with the TAC regimen. By extrapolation, you're better by giving six cycles of FAC or CAF. You can make those regimens better by making them dose dense. So we've come a long way from just four cycles of AC. So in my practice, this has had a relatively minor impact because I hadn't given someone four cycles of AC alone for probably 3 years. I gave those low-risk patients CMF, and some of them I now give TC because they're done faster. And for some of my younger patients, that's an advantage. But I'm just not as convinced that anthracyclines don't still have a role. And we may put patients at risk by dumping them without really testing this question that will be so easy to test if the TIC-TAC trial is appropriately sized.
What are your thoughts about the strategy of combining an anti-angiogenic agent, and in this case it's bevacizumab, with trastuzumab? That's going to be looked at in the BETH study. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, both from the sort of practical clinical research point of view as well as from the laboratory point of view?
So incredibly exciting. We actually worried when we designed 2100 that we might be putting ourselves in a hole because we excluded the HER2-positive patients. And preclinical data and clinical correlative data from Mark Pegram and Godfrey Konecny had suggested that we might be excluding the patients most likely to benefit from inhibiting VEGF because of the frequent co-expression of HER2 and VEGF and their laboratory data that inhibiting both pathways was more effective. They've now taken that back to the clinic, and in a phase 2 study that's been reported in preliminary form, truly amazing response rates of just over 50% with the two antibodies without chemotherapy. So I am very enthusiastic about the BETH trial, which will take this rapidly to the adjuvant setting. There are some potential cardiac toxicities with the two agents. Mark saw that in their original phase 2 study with some patients, a fair number of them, with asymptomatic declines in ejection fraction, one patient with profound symptomatic heart failure. At about the same time, we and my colleagues in the Hoosier Oncology Group were doing a study based on the same concept and the same hypothesis, simply using a different VEGF-targeted therapy in combination with trastuzumab. Our trial was stopped after seven patients.
Which was? What was the agent?
PTK-787. It was stopped after seven patients because of excess toxicity, including one patient with symptomatic congestive heart failure. So I've talked...
That's the TKI that was studied in colon?
Was studied in colon cancer, the lesson of which should be that you should never name a trial confirm one
right.
when you don't have positive results that need confirmation. That just seems to lead to the fate smacking you. I can tell you the drug certainly does something, because in combination with trastuzumab, we saw significant toxicity, and after 7 patients decided this was prohibitive. But this was going on concurrently with Mark's phase 1 trial. So within a couple of months, Mark and I both experienced a patient treated with combined HER2 and VEGF inhibition without presence of chemotherapy have profound symptomatic congestive heart failure. So I think that potential for interaction is quite real. Mark's data with larger experience and very careful follow-up, I think, also says that it's not likely to be prohibitive. But whether you will get even more heart failure with less selected, broader representative patient population with the addition of chemotherapy, I think is still a question for the Beth trial. I don't think that that risk means that trial shouldn't go forward, and I'm actually very excited to see that trial going forward because I do think that's a population that might get even greater benefit.
What do you think about the possibility of considering that combination in metastatic disease far down the line? Somebody's been responding to a bunch of other things, and you just keep looking for more things outside a protocol setting.
I must admit I have done that on a couple of occasions. It worries me on a cardiac toxicity front because those are patients who almost certainly have been exposed to an anthracycline at some point in the past. So that's a potential toxicity issue. There are the obvious reimbursement issues. And really, there's no data in that setting because Mark's trial and the trial that we were doing with PTK-787 was in newly diagnosed patients who had not been exposed to either agent or either class of agents. Though I must admit, on a couple of occasions, I have done it. And in at least one occasion, I think the patient was clearly responding, though she developed a community-acquired pneumonia from which she became profoundly ill and died before we could get scans to prove that she was responding.
So community-acquired pneumonia, wow.
Streptococcal sepsis.
Jeez.
Yes.
And neutropenic?
No.
Wow.
Not at all. I think certainly in the context of the Beth trial, in the context of the E1105 trial, which explores that dual inhibition in patients with metastatic disease, in Mark's trial in the untreated patients, I'm very enthusiastic about it. I think there are enough unresolved toxicity concerns that it's not something I would suggest people reach for in those highly refractory patients.
I'm curious about your perception about some of the new biologic agents that are being tested out there right now for the oncologists in practice. You know, it's just like you see these dizzying numbers of pathways and agents and just like, well, let me know when it's ready, you know, for taking care of patients. But what are some of the things that either you've worked with or you're hearing about in terms of biologic agents or molecularly based agents for breast cancer that you're most excited about?
There are several. First, I'm very excited about other ways of inhibiting HER2. At ASCO this year, there were at least 4 abstracts reporting other ways of inhibiting the HER2 pathway besides trastuzumab, besides lapatinib, all studied in patients who had had previous trastuzumab therapy and were progressing on trastuzumab therapy, all reporting response rates between 10 and 15%. So clearly suggesting that there's more to be gained by inhibiting the HER2 pathway at different levels.
The two that I've been curious about, and it's so hard for an oncologist to hear about 10% response rate. You don't know what to think. Like, I sometimes want to know, are there people out there, you know, just individuals who have really striking responses? But the two that I've heard a lot about are T-DM1 and pertuzumab. Can you comment on what they are and what we know about them?
So pertuzumab is another monoclonal antibody. It also binds to HER2, to the extracellular domain, but to a different epitope than trastuzumab. And it inhibits interaction of HER2 with all of the other HER family members. So it prevents dimerization, which is important for signaling. T-DM1 is a conjugated product, antibody conjugated to a cytotoxic agent, biologic cytotoxic agent, rather than traditional chemotherapy. And I understand people in practice saying 10%, what's 10%? But this is 10% in patients who had progressed on trastuzumab, in many patients had progressed on lapatinib, that had anthracyclines, taxanes, multiple previous therapies. Many of these trials didn't exclude patients on the basis of number of previous therapies as long as they were healthy enough. So this is only a glimmer of the potential activity of these agents, because these are the patients where you really wouldn't expect anything to work. And there are patients who've had really dramatic, amazing responses. So these are not necessarily patients who just squeaked under the response bar on their scans for 5 weeks so you could call it a confirmed response and then progress. These were real responses, clinically important to the patients in whom they occurred.
It's funny, I was talking to Chuck Vogel, and he was talking about the late 90s when trastuzumab came out, and he was very skeptical about it. Of course, nobody knew what was going to happen. Put a few patients on the pivotal trial, put a few patients on his trial, trastuzumab alone, didn't really see anything. And then all of a sudden, somebody came in with liver mets, last-ditch stuff, treats the patient, you know, they stay on it for a couple of years, great response, and that was when his eyes opened. And any other anti-HER2 agents that are, you know, maybe these two sound like they're not that far away, maybe, from coming to the clinic? Anything else?
Well, a couple that on the face of them may not sound like HER2-targeted agents. So several HSP90 inhibitors.
Heat shock protein?
Heat shock protein 90. So to,
I like the name.
You like the name.
What is it, though?
So to recall basic biology, cells don't like unbound proteins just floating freely in their cytoplasm. So if cells are made in the internal part of the cell, processed in the Golgi apparatus, they then have to get from inside of the cell to the cell surface or wherever in the cell they are supposed to be active. And they can't just float freely in the cell or they will be immediately degraded. So the heat shock proteins bind to these proteins that have been produced, chaperone them, protect them, if you will, to get them to where they're going, deposit them in the membrane so that they can be functional. Now, heat shock proteins are the chaperone protein for the HER2 receptor. They're also the chaperone proteins for a lot of other receptors, not just HER2.
Where does the proteasome come in?
So proteasome is what actually does the degrading.
So the heat shock protein is taken to the proteasome? Or?
No. Heat shock protein prevents them from getting dumped to the proteasome.
Ah, okay.
So unchaperoned proteins immediately shunted to the garbage dump to get chewed up, otherwise known as the proteasome. If you have a chaperone, your own personal bodyguard, otherwise known as HSP90, it walks you through the mean streets of the cell, deposits you in the nice suburb along the cell membrane where you can be active. So you can't safely transverse that danger zone without your chaperone. And HSP90 does that for a lot of receptors and a lot of cell signaling proteins, not just HER2. But HER2 is definitely one of them. And in the laboratory, if you treat a HER2-positive cell with an HSP90 inhibitor and then restain it, there are significant decreases in the amount of HER2 receptor on the cell surface. So you've, in essence, decreased HER2 signaling. These are agents that have been studied as monotherapy as well as in combination with trastuzumab, again, in these highly refractory patients, and again, with response rates of 10 to 20% in these studies. So very encouraging in this refractory population. The other is the mTOR inhibitors, which is way downstream of HER2 signaling. HER2 signaling eventually has to work its way through mTOR to have an effect on gene expression of all of the things that HER2 signaling does. So inhibiting mTOR also inhibits the effectiveness of HER2 signaling. And a similar trial looking at these refractory patients with an mTOR inhibitor also found low but definite and encouraging response rates.
So I guess, was that the RAD001?
Yes.
Yeah. I find the mTOR inhibitors the hardest to pronounce. I spent 2 years in renal trying to learn how
on
to say
Temsirolimus. Oh.
Or Everolimus, you know, it's just, I don't like it. But anyhow.
I was wondering why you were struggling to pronounce mTOR.
Oh, no, mTOR is easy. It's the actual generic. What about the side effect profile of these new agents, pertuzumab, TDM1, mTOR, et cetera?
So pertuzumab side effects have been very similar to trastuzumab because it doesn't seem to prevent signaling from unrelated receptors. Heat shock 90 protein inhibitors have a different toxicity profile because they're important chaperone proteins for so many other signaling proteins. They have been most limited by general fatigue, muscle pain, arthralgia, myalgia syndrome that is clearly related to cumulative exposure, and a dry eye keratitis problem, sometimes to the point of corneal ulcerations. That's been particularly difficult in looking for patients eligible for the ongoing trials because it excludes patients with dry eyes based on the Schirmer's test. And that's a big issue for patients who've had boatloads of chemotherapy before that I was unaware of its impact on tear production. The TDM agent has also had not much significant toxicity because it doesn't have a lot of off-target effects. So no unusual or troublesome toxicities beside what you would expect from HER2-targeted agents.
What about EGFR inhibitors? I was kind of like getting ready to give up on that because it just seems like there was negative study after negative study. Ken Osborne was saying, you know, this should work. And then there was a paper at ASCO that looked like it was fairly positive for gefitinib.
So I have to admit, I'm still not enthusiastic. The paper you mentioned at ASCO was a trial done at MD Anderson, stopped because of poor accrual, and then analyzed with the numbers they have. And with very small numbers, only about 70 to 80 patients randomized, a suggestion of improved progression-free survival.
But I mean, the curves look pretty cool.
The curves do look very cool, and you know, the folks at MD Anderson do good work. I have no concerns that the data are what they are. But it's one very small study with clear selection bias that went into who enrolled in that trial because it accrued so slowly at a very large institution, and we don't have any good way of ferreting out what selection biases went into who was offered participation in that trial.